Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
My next guest is a distinguished university professor of Christian ethics and director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercy University in Atlanta, Georgia, in the USA. Ethics is a topic which has been at the forefront of education in some of our schools over the past year or so, with the introduction of ethics classes. But what do we mean when we use the word ethics? Dr. David Gushy should be able to help us out. He's here consulting on ethics with Christian Super. David, welcome to Open House.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
It's wonderful to see you, and I look forward to this chat immensely. Help us out. What are we talking about when we talk about ethics?
Well, essentially, I mean, a place to start is ethics is the study of moral values, moral convictions. And so at one level, ethics as a discipline describes how people think about morality, how people think about right and wrong, good and evil, how they're supposed to live their lives. At another level, ethics is, you might call it, the effort within specific communities to define or to understand what is right and what is wrong. So as an ethicist, part of what I do is make proposals as to what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. And then also to study different cultures and religions and so on and talk about what ideas are out there already.
There'll be different frameworks, though.
That's right.
That will determine right or wrong. What sort of frameworks are you talking about?
It's so interesting because I think human beings are inextricably moral creatures in the sense that, I mean, just as we're physical creatures and biological creatures and relational creatures, we are moral creatures. Every human society has a lively discussion at all times about what does a good life look like and how we're supposed to live and what is right and what is wrong. And a lot of times where you see that happen is if somebody violates the norms, then they get the whole house will come down on them to communicate that you've crossed a boundary line. So there's something wired into the human being that has us, all of us, intensely interested in what is right and what is wrong. Different religious traditions produce their own versions of ethics. So there's Jewish ethics and Christian ethics and Muslim ethics, and multiple variations within each of these.
Yes.
And there are secular traditions in ethics. So the paradox is ethics, the wrestling with what is right and what is wrong, good and bad, is a universal human phenomenon. But you also have multiple traditions in ethics. And in a pluralistic society, these traditions and ethics kind of bump up against each other. And we encounter each other's distinctive beliefs every day.
There are also what are called situational ethics. Can you describe what that is and how they arise?
When I think of that term, I think about an actual ethical system called situational ethics that was developed in the late 50s by a guy named Joseph Fletcher, who was a Christian cleric, kind of a liberal one. And he basically said that the right thing to do is what you can intuit or decide in specific situations, that Christian ethics had overemphasized rules and principles. And what we really needed was kind of doing the loving thing as it struck us in specific situations. That's kind of situational ethics. I think a lot of Western culture these days is essentially situational in its ethics. People kind of come to a gut response to life and they just feel their way forward, and that's where they get their ethics.
Because probably from the 50s there has been that move away from a more strict ethical framework that had its roots in, say, the Christian faith or probably other faiths.
That's right. Pre-1960s, paradigm, how do I know what I'm supposed to do? I talk to my pastor, I talk to my priest, I read the Bible, I pay attention to the Christian tradition. It tells me authoritatively what to do. Post-1960s, those authorities were displaced, and people were more likely to go with their gut, to go with their instincts. I don't think it worked out very well, but that's what a lot of people
do. Yeah, so I determine my own ethics, basically.
Based on what my heart tells me to do.
So you're saying that ethics change with the passage of time, perhaps culture, movement, technology?
People's understanding of right and wrong definitely changes across eras and cultures, and even within the same culture over different periods of time. Look at Western attitudes, say, towards divorce in 1930 compared to 2010. That doesn't mean from a Christian perspective that I would believe that God is constantly shifting what God thinks about what is right and what is wrong. But human moral beliefs definitely change over time.
How do we set out to teach ethics, do you think? I'm sure you've considered that a lot from where you come from, especially children, I suppose.
Children soak up the moral lifestyle of their parents, of the adults who raise them, first of all. They learn ethics from watching their parents. I think they also learn ethics by whatever sources of influence are allowed to shape their character, whether it's church or what's happening in school or what they're watching on television or in the movies or on the computer. Children are sponges. They soak up everything that's going on around them. Some ethicists actually suggest that it's almost impossible to teach ethics in terms of I'm now going to introduce moral theories in cases. They think that ethics is more like it's caught, like the flu. It's absorbed more than it can be rationally taught. On the other hand, people still try to teach rational versions of ethics every day in schools.
So as a kid, perhaps, absorbing an ethical framework and forming that, what are the things that are going to teach me and how am I going to know or be directed to a particular ethical framework? Is it just the pragmatics of what works and what doesn't, or what pushes my buttons?
I'm attracted to the idea that all of us are drawn to the good, the true, and the beautiful.
Okay.
And
albeit in a fallen world.
In a fallen world. And so we may not have a really good idea what is good, true, and beautiful. But we learn about a good life, a good moral life, by watching a good moral life be lived around us.
It's kind of doing to others what you would have them do to you.
As you see people who live well, whose relationships flourish, who are people of integrity, who keep their promises, who are kind, that's attractive. And also, I've known a lot of young people. I teach college students, and who've also grown up in a lot of moral chaos. As you see people living badly, it's intuitive to sense, this is not how life is supposed to be lived. I'm going to do it differently. So I've seen people learn ethics from negative example, watching their parents make a mess of their lives, saying, I'm not going to do what my parents did.
That moral chaos of which you speak, worse than previous generations, do you think?
I think that it is, in part because, at least in Christianly influenced cultures, there was a broadly shared moral vision, heavily influenced by the church's influence. Now, it seems that influence, the Christian influence, has faded and everybody's making up their own rules as they go along. But still, I think lives that are well-lived flourish. Lives that are not well-lived tend to disintegrate into chaos and conflict, and anybody can see that the one is better than the other.
That drift from Christian ethics, has that been happening in other faiths as well? You mentioned Jewish and Islam.
You'd have to talk about that at two different levels. I mean, you'd have to talk about specific cultures. What's happening in Great Britain? What's happening in South Africa? What's happening in Australia or the U.S.? I mean, and I think the general pattern is that all of these Western cultures have gone more secular. But you still have the churches each week and in every other opportunity shaping the character of their members through what happens on Sundays and what happens in every other opportunity that Christians train one another. Kind of a trend in ethics, in Christian ethics these days, is coming to grips with the fact of our fading cultural influence, but trying not to give in to despair about that, because Christians are still shaping disciples and training hearts and affecting families and individual lives every time we gather together. This is sometimes called a more of a church-based understanding of shaping disciples as opposed to a cultural-based understanding of shaping cultures. We'd like to shape the culture. We may not have as much influence as we once did.
Yes. Are Christian ethics just the same as being a good Christian, do you think?
I think that, for me, Christian ethics is a life of imitation of Jesus Christ and obedience to his teachings. Being a good Christian is a kind of vague phrase. Nice, kind, you know, you don't tell lies and you're generally kind to people, help little old ladies cross the street.
If only.
Yeah. But I think Christian ethics has a lot of substance to it that goes beyond just being a nice person.
You seem to be quite optimistic about human nature and not so much addressing the inherent dark side that does lurk there not too far beneath the surface in all of us.
I'm an Orthodox Christian, and I believe that we were made good and we have fallen into sin, but that Christ seeks to redeem all people. I also believe that that redemptive process involves not just getting people to believe in him, but getting people to live changed lives. And I'm optimistic in the sense that I've watched Jesus Christ change a lot of lives. But I'm properly pessimistic in the sense that we all need to have our lives changed.
You're a realist.
I'm a realist about human nature.
On Open House, we're with Dr. David Gushy, Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercy University in Atlanta, Georgia. David, I know that in one of your books, you particularly dealt with the role of Christian people during the Holocaust of World War II. Can you tell us something about what happened with them?
It was actually my very first book, my doctoral dissertation. I just became transfixed with the question, not so long ago in Europe, when the Nazis were trying to kill every single Jew, where was the church? Where were the Christians?
Yeah.
And the basic answer was that most Christians did not rise to the challenge to help their Jewish neighbors. They were scared, or they were busy with their own affairs, or they didn't like Jews, and so prejudice got the better of them. Well under 1% of Christians in Europe lifted a finger to try to help Jews survive. Yeah. But best estimate, maybe as many as 250,000 Christians helped to save maybe as many as 250,000 to 500,000 Jews. So I think there are a lot of stories there worth telling. In the book, The Righteous Gentiles of the Holocaust, I tell stories of rescuers while also being realistic about all the Christians who did not rescue.
So what was your conclusion about why so few helped?
Most people are not courageous. Most people are, especially in a wartime situation, they're wrapped up in their own affairs. They're just trying to get through the day.
Yes.
A stranger comes to your door and presents a moral challenge to you as a Christian. Sadly, most Christians did not respond with courageous rescue. They were scared. The Nazis made clear that anybody who helped Jews risked being sent off to a camp or killed themselves. So most people are not courageous, but some people were passionately courageous and passionately faithful to Christ, and they risked everything to save even strangers.
So fear would be one of the greatest enemies of an ethical framework.
I think it is. Fear, self-protection, all those things that keep us focused on ourselves instead of on loving our neighbors.
Where does an understanding of ethics come into something like discussions, for instance, about one of the great issues of the world at the moment, the environment? Does it or should it shape that?
In ethics, we deal with every significant moral challenge, okay, whether it's marriage and family life or sexuality or abortion or war or the environment. One key principle of ethics is responsibility to others. And in an environment, it has become clear that we have to ask about responsibility to others now. What kind of energy and environmental practices are responsible and to our neighbors now, but also to future neighbors who don't exist yet, our grandchildren's generation. So that's sometimes called an ethic of intergenerational responsibility. My father, who was a policy analyst for the government in the United States, used to say that just about every policy issue involves considerations of facts and interests and values. And so there are very few policy issues that are discussed in governmental context or in public conversation that don't have an ethical dimension to them. Hmm. It's just a matter of wrestling with what ethical obligations we have and to whom.
And to be clear, we're not talking about Christian ethics specifically. It's just an ethical framework.
It's an ethical framework for any decision where human well-being is at stake.
Yes. Australia is very much a multicultural nation. How do we begin to discuss ethics in that kind of society where people's backgrounds are very, very different?
Two basic proposals, I think, have surfaced in relation to diversity like this. One has been to try to get everybody to speak a kind of a common ethical language. And so, for example, you strip out all religious references and all specific, like, you know, biblical citations or whatever, and you speak a language that everybody can understand. This is often how public conversation happens in a pluralistic society. And one kind of lingua franca for that is the language of rights, which is now very broadly shared. The problem with that is, especially for Christians, but I think it would be true for Muslims and many others, this thin kind of universal language doesn't really get at the heart of our faith. So a more recent development is to say, let's let everybody come into the public square and bring their values into the public square, speak the language that is native to them. Let Jews make Jewish moral arguments and Muslims make Muslim moral arguments and Christians make Christian moral arguments and see if we can discover overlap, see if we can discover consensus that surprises us. And in my own experience, that's actually a richer kind of conversation. I'd rather have everybody talk out of the heart of their values and see if we can surprise one another with common ground than try to have a thin moral conversation where nobody's really speaking their native language.
Just this past year, as I mentioned earlier, an ethics course was introduced into primary schools in New South Wales. Great thing, of course, but they've been set in opposition to the scripture lessons, which have been legislated in that state for more than 100 years. If you have a framework of ethics, does that mean you don't need something like scripture classes or, I suppose, the Bible?
I find that this whole discussion fascinating. I was here last summer, 2010, when this was just really being talked about. First of all, in the U.S., our church-state legal framework would never, would not now permit scripture lessons being taught in the primary schools to children. I'm struck that that still exists.
Yes, I suppose.
It's so different. It's really unfortunate for me as an ethicist, as a Christian ethicist, that Bible versus ethics would end up in conflict with each other. It's just kind of an odd political development. Personally, I'd like to see kids shaped with both. If I were designing a curriculum, I would integrate biblical and ethical materials. What I fear is developing here is a kind of liberal ethics on the one hand versus conservative biblical teaching on the other. And that's an unfortunate and odd political development, which I think is preventable.
Why unfortunate, do you think?
Okay, if we assume a school framework where you're actively trying to shape the vision and way of life of children, teach them both scripture and get them exposed to the broad moral principles, theories, and challenges of our time. I think it ought to be possible to get the leading advocates of both sides together and come up with a grand compromise to get both ethics taught and scripture taught. It's what I do every day. I teach Christian ethics. We do scripture and we do ethics.
Can you understand parents who might want to just blow the ethical question out of, as they would see it, religion? For religion and the church have not had, especially in this last generation, a good reputation ethically.
Because as I said earlier, there are so many different traditions in ethics. What I think that they're likely to get in a pure ethics curriculum is a kind of some version of Western moral philosophy without the Christian material. I mean, it's valuable. It has its place. It's better than no ethical instruction. To strip the Christian roots out of that Western moral philosophical framework is to cut the foundation out from under it. It's also ahistorical because I think Western moral philosophy begins with a Christian origin and then evolves from there.
The extent to which Christian ethics or the Bible have influenced Western civilization.
Very deep. In fact, I've just completed a book on the idea that human life is sacred, and as I trace the development of this idea, my conclusion, and I think it would be true of other ideas, is that most significant moral concepts in Western culture begin as some combination of biblical teaching and Greek philosophy. You get into the modern period and the biblical theological base gets whacked away, just kind of knocked out, and all you end up with is the Greek philosophy and then modern developments that go from there. It's just actually inaccurate to think that those ideas, our ideas of freedom and justice and rights and human dignity, can be severed from the Christian ideas that are ultimately their origin.
Would you acknowledge your bias coming to this question as a Christian person?
I would, but I could also cite philosophers who are not Christians who would say, yes, most major Western ethical ideas have biblical or Christian roots. They would usually then go on to say they can survive just fine without them, but they would acknowledge historically that our ideas of rights or justice or whatever flow from the wellsprings of our civilization, which is theological, biblical.
You mentioned your students before who've grown up in, as you put it, a degree of moral chaos. Mm-hmm. That is worse than past generations. And their determination to do better.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic for the future?
I am really worried about it, actually. I believe that God is sovereign over this world and that ultimately the outcome of history will conform with God's will. But I don't think that human beings do well without powerful examples and teachings and a moral framework. Kids who are raised only on what they can get on their computer and on TV and in the movies, along with the chaotic lives of the adults around them, I am not optimistic about them.
But they do desire better.
They desire better. And a lot of times, if there could just be one adult, a teacher, a friend at church, somebody to come along and just live a good life in their presence, then they could be transformed in very pivotal years. The students who came out of moral chaos, what they tend to have in common, the ones I'm talking about who I have a lot of hope for, they ended up in church sometime in high school where they met a teacher who was a good example for them and really invested in them. I call on listeners who care about the future to invest in young people. Take time with young people and show them a life worth living. Not arrogantly, just let them get near you. And live a good life in the presence of young people, and it will pay off for the future.
Particularly as teachers, do you think?
I think teachers have a huge influence. Even teachers who are not Christians or attempting to advance a specific Christian agenda, if you love kids and you care about them and you invest in them and you want their potential to be realized, then a lot of times you're the only adult in their life who has ever invested in them. So I think teachers have enormous opportunities here.
Dr. David Gushy, very, very grateful for your time. I was enormously looking forward to this chat, and it's been terrific. I'm sure everybody else has been absorbed and really connected. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.